Welcome to OC Housing Connection Program, Orange County's number one trusted resource for all your real estate and home mortgage news. Here are your hosts, Hamid and Faye Hamadachi.
Hello, everyone. We hope you had a fun and relaxing weekend. Let's get started today by talking about real estate and mortgages. I'm here with my co-host, Faye, as well as our sound engineer, Paul.
I'm so glad Faye's back. I'm so glad.
Hi. Welcome back, Faye.
I'm glad you missed me.
Well, let's talk about real estate a little bit and see how it's doing. One of the news that I have is that the unsold inventory in Orange County is only 3.9 months, which is very low.
And you were telling, I don't know if you can share these or not, but you were telling some anecdotal evidence just of your own experience over the last couple of weeks, showing houses, renting houses, whatnot.
Yesterday I was actually showing houses, and some of the homes that I was showing to my clients, they had open houses. And the open houses were very crowded. A lot of people were stopping by looking at those homes. That shows how much interest there is for buying a house. And, you know, this number that says 3.9 months of inventory left, that's another figure that's important, because as a realtor, you want to see about 6 to 7 months of unsold inventory. That's a balanced market. That's when buyers and sellers are, you know, basically...
There's as many of each.
Exactly. Yeah. Whereas when, 3.9 months, in LA it's 4.9 months, so it's a little bit higher, but in Orange County, 3.9 months of unsold inventory, that's very low.
Well, we had some data this morning also on the newly built
homes. Oh, it's coming in right now as we talk here then. And, I heard something ding, so I don't know if that's like a live report coming in.
No. This is came out this morning as the sales of newly built home fell for the third straight month in March. They were expecting single-family home fell 1.5% from March earlier.
Is that nationwide or just here?
Nationwide.
Right.
And they were expecting about 520, and it came in about 511. So I was a little bit, but, these data changes month to month, and this is national data, so I just thought I should...
Okay.
Orange County, though, seems to be an anomaly.
Orange County is actually more expensive. Our median home is... $721,000.
Wow.
You know, inventory is only 3.9 months. And then a median time on the market for homes are 49 days. That's pretty
good. That's pretty fast.
Especially with the price, median price being at $721,000.
So, and from correct me if I'm wrong, but one of Faye's earlier shows said the average closing time is more like 45 days, not 30 days, because of the extra requirements of the Consumer Protection Bureau and stuff.
But this is a different part. 49 is on the market. It's actually from the time it's listed to the time that they get the offer.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Once they get the offer, yes, it could be 45 days. It could be 60 days, depending on what kind of loan they're getting, how many client, how many buyers are there, and, interested, etc.
Well, with the new laws, with the mortgage laws, you have to, I'll give you an example. Like when you get your appraisal, we have to give you 3 days after that. We can, like if I gave you an appraisal, I couldn't close your loan tomorrow. I have to wait for 3 days.
Why is that? Just to make sure.
It's a law, is a law.
What's the theory behind that? That somehow...
That I guess you need more time as a consumer to look at your appraisal.
Oh, I see.
Look at your documents, make sure you know what
it's like. And it's
they're trying to slow it down so you have more time to look at them.
Well, it's 3 days once we give you the closing disclosures. Like another, every time anything changes, there's a 3-day waiting period. Now, when you refinance a home, you also get 3 days of rescission after you sign everything.
Ooh, I didn't know that.
This is the law. If you are doing a refinance, after you sign your final documents, you have 3 days. For any reasons you want to back out, you can back out.
You don't
have to give anybody a reason.
Right.
So that's why it's taking longer, because of all the waiting period.
That's probably good, though, because a lot of people felt forced or pressured or whatever, and they weren't sure what they were doing. But there's a pressure to keep moving forward once you start the process. And the theory was that people were doing things unwisely.
Yeah, but it does cost the consumer, because let's say if you got to wait another 3 days for me to give you this paper and another 3 days for that paper, you may not make your lock period, and which means you have to buy an extension. So it's not really, I don't think it's that good for the consumer, because...
What does that mean, lock period? Lock period
well,
is...
Well, when you go to, you apply for a loan, you can lock your loan. Before you lock your loan, is basically you have really nothing. It's just a quote.
Right.
So once you lock your loan, you know, we send you a lock confirmation with, you know, with all the numbers on the
loan estimate.
And then that means that's your final numbers. Now, if anything changes with that final numbers, and if your interest rate moves up by an eighth or anything, any of the costs changes more than $100, it's costs that you can't shop for because they have different costs. There are certain things you can shop for. And there's certain things you really don't have an option of shopping for. So if those numbers change, then you have to, you know, have a valid reason as why you're changing it and then have to wait for another 3 days. And, you know, I'll give you an example. Like, you know, we're talking, let's say you wanted to get a loan where you were going to pay points and then you change your mind. Mm-hmm. You don't want to pay points. Well, I have to change your interest rate, which means your rate would be higher, but your upfront cost would be lower.
Got it.
That will kick in the 3 days.
It's not a cooling period, but it's similar to what they call a cooling period.
Right.
That three-day rescission has always been there. That's I think it's the same for cars too.
I think
they give you a cooling, but not on a purchase. You sign your pretty much.
But on those 3 days that you do for the loans, it's basically to give the consumer time to read it, so they can say, "I went to their office, they put it in front of me, I signed it."
Yeah.
I didn't know what I'm signing.
No excuse if you've got 3 days, right?
Well, that to me is actually you need to give, because when a consumer signs their loan document, they're signing over 100 pages. There's nobody. I mean, in the years I've done loans, there's only probably one customer that I have that reads everything.
I tried to, of course, and they yelled at me and said, "What are you doing? We don't have time to read this."
Well, that's why you have 3 days if you're refinancing.
Right.
And I have a customer that he always reads everything, and I know, like, I would give him the paperwork, go say read it for a day or two, and then we'll
come back. All right, so that's all positive feeling that
the economy in Orange County is very good, Paul. Employment rate is very, very good.
Tell your other anecdotal story about
Let me tell you about the industrial first, because our industrial vacancy rate in Orange County is 1.5%.
That's hard to, but 1.5%.
That's amazing.
I mean, it's never going to go to zero, because there's always going to be somebody moving in, moving out.
Exactly, and what that means is, if you're renting right now, you're going to be paying more, because the landlord is going to be asking you more when there's so much, so little vacancy.
Right.
Or if you want to rent a new one, you got to pay a lot to rent.
They just raised my rent
here,
and they argued that because of the low occupancy, kind of like take it or leave it.
Exactly. So that means employment picture is very good. Big industrial buildings are usually used for factories, for warehouses, which employ a lot of people.
Yeah.
That's good news versus white-collar type of work, which is usually an office. It could be maybe 3-4 people in that office.
I wonder what office vacancies are. That's going to be pretty low these days, too.
Office vacancy has improved a lot, but it's not as good as industrial.
Yeah. Well, and part of that goes to the fact that there's so little industrial in Orange County, too. Wouldn't you say this isn't a heavily industrialized county?
Yeah. So. Well, one of the things that happened last few years was, as there was a big demand for residential, a lot of industrial building was converted into residential.
I saw that. They were the empty industrial, they were tearing them down.
And in fact, there's quite a few of them right around Irvine. If you see near Jamboree, Von Carmen, and the campus area, those areas, you see a few actually that are being built right now. The few that were built, and so on. So
I saw them tear down a multi-story office building in Laguna Niguel, right near the Costco there, and turn it into a multi-story apartment complex.
Because there's more demand, they can get better prices for it. And,
But in my lifetime, I would have never thought once an office building is up, even if it was a bad decision to build it and it sits empty forever, few people ever bought that building and tore it down.
Yeah. Now, it's something interesting, though. I've got to tell you this. I just found this out. One of the Caltech engineers, he got this website that he can check to see how noisy a neighborhood is.
Ooh, okay.
It takes into effect traffic, freeway noise.
Airplane
noise, and factory noises.
Yes.
Now, what I'm wondering is, if you buy something in an industrial area, which was previously an industrial building, would that be noisier than, say, in a residential neighborhood?
Yeah, might be.
Usually, a real estate agent advertises a home close to schools, walking distance to shopping, which are very good. But they never talk about how noisy that neighborhood is.
Never.
But by going on this website, you can actually check to see how noisy your neighborhood is. And he's done it for 1,000 of big cities, basically, not rural areas.
The name of the website is?
SoundScore.
Sound you can score.
Well, I'm sure you don't need to worry about noise level in the rural area. They call that the boonies, right?
That's why they haven't done it. But crickets. It's an interesting thing to find out. If you're concerned with how noisy my neighborhood is, mm-hmm. you can go in there, put in your address, and it comes back and gives you scores, you know, 60 or...
Did you try yours?
No, I didn't try mine, but, you know, the samples that they give you, for example, it says traffic is calm, airport is calm, you know, other sources are calm, or it could be a noisy traffic. The airport is noisy, for example, if you're close to...
John Wayne is probably giving you noise,
you know, busy or so, and so on.
And where they're going to build more industrial, I wonder if it takes into account what's coming on board. Because now that industrial is so low, maybe we'll see the opposite. There's a theory, I just read this, that we've reached the saturation point for apartments and that maybe we've overbuilt apartments in Orange County here. That was one theory in a recent article.
I'm not sure of that because I read the data this morning, actually, that, you know, LA County, Orange County, San Diego, Riverside, and San Bernardino, they're building 30, they have pulled permits for 38,000 multiple units.
So, it have like we always do, do we over, whenever suddenly there was a shortage of apartments, so everybody built, and did we go too far, just like they did when they built shopping centers or other
Yes,
sorts
they
of
usually do that, but we haven't reached that point yet.
Okay.
I think there is a shortage of housing.
Definitely.
Dramatic shortage. But I just wonder if apartments, at some point, they're going to say, oh, we better tear those down and build industrial, because industrial has only got 1% vacancy and apartments have got 20% vacancy.
The problem is land. We don't have that much land left in Orange County. So.
And you can't easily swap one for another, residential and commercial.
There's going to be a lot of resistance in the neighborhood if you have an apartment complex and you're going to change to industrial versus the other one. You know, it's easier to convert an industrial zone into residential than going the other way.
Although then you get people complaining about increased traffic. We're going to have the trucks were only so many, and now there's a million cars because of the apartments.
True. But I think it's going to be easier to go from industrial to residential than go from...
All positive noise, all positive little anecdotal evidence.
Oh, very good. Now, I give you another example of how hot the rental market is. I had a listing for rent in San Clemente, and the previous tenant was paying $4,000.
Which seems astronomical to me anyway,
exactly.
For rent a house.
And then I suggested to the landlord, you know, we should rent it for, we should list it for $4,500. Hopefully we get somebody, we get a couple of $100s if they want to negotiate and bring it down.
Just as a negotiating tactic. You didn't think you were going to get it.
And the landlord was very happy. If I could rent it for them for $4,300, they would have been very happy. Except we got offers of $4,300, $4,500, $5,000, and
$6,000.
Wow. I was shocked.
Wow.
I mean, that's a lot of money that people are willing to pay for rent. And it tells you how tight the market is.
And so, do people at that range never expect to own, or is this just their... you said this had a slight ocean view, that's just the price you pay to live near the ocean.
It's a combination of all. Some people are paying... in fact, I know a friend of mine who has rented his house to a very nice couple, and they basically can't move out because they said, you know, we can't save enough. They both make good money. They just can't save enough for a down payment.
I'll give you some other anecdotal evidence. This was a shocker to me. My own wife, out of the blue, we were talking about our house and, you know, someday we're going to sell it or do whatever we're going to do next. I want to go to the desert where I inherited this house. I've talked about it many times. And she says, you know what? The next house I move to, I'm going to rent. I said, what?
Why?
And she said, I'm tired of taking care of the damn thing and worrying about the yard and worrying about this. I think the people who rent have it all. And I'm thinking, for how many years we rented? And she's like, we got to buy. And it was a good thing. We built a lot of equity. And I've heard other friends of mine say the same sentiment, either in seriousness or not. This idea is, I get older, I don't want to worry about any of this stuff. Why? Maybe I should just rent.
I disagree.
I disagree.
This is a woman who, for 20 years, was pushing me to buy, and now suddenly...
Thank God she pushed you.
Yes, thank God she did. And then all of a sudden, she's just casually saying, well, what's so great about owning a house?
It would be a better part to rent your home and maybe go to Leisure World or somewhere, you know, somewhere where they take care of everything for you. You don't have to worry about
it. I just thought that was shocking. I never thought those words would come out of her mouth here.
I know,
well,
right?
I'm sure when she sees the check, the capital gain from the sale of your home, she'll think twice about it.
And absolutely.
You wouldn't have that check if you had not bought.
That was the smartest move we ever made, particularly at the time we bought and with the growth of Orange County. Will my children ever see that same appreciation, or will they even look for it? We've said, are they going to live in New York, San Francisco, Chicago, places that they just don't expect ever to own?
You never know. It's not, when I first moved to Orange County in 1979, I looked at home prices. I had just graduated from college.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, you must be crazy. You'll never
$200,000, yeah.
You won't be able to buy homes here. And then, you know, here's 35 years later or so, and I'm a homeowner, and I'm very happy in Orange County. You never know how things turn out. You know, prices may go down, you get a better job, etc. So, you never know.
I just fear that Orange County is going to move into one of those rare neighborhoods where people rent their whole life.
I don't know if it's going to be. It's going to be a good rental market, I think, mainly because we have not enough land to build more homes.
Right.
And the prices are going up so much. But whether it's going to be predominantly or majority rentals, I don't think so. We still have enough homes, and there's still enough, you know, activity going on.
Going to put all the realtors out of business if they're just rentals.
It probably would, yeah.
Well, owning a home is a dream, and
I think
it's always going to be a dream.
Yeah, so
you say so, but your two children, you said, don't dream the same dream you dreamed.
Of course they do. We'll make them go there.
They're still young, you know. They're still young.
My
son is actually very much against owning a home, and he says it's not such a good tax write-off and so on. And, you know, he's got some valid points, yeah, because, you know, most people their standard deduction is $12,600.
Uh-huh.
And an average home in U.S. is $200,000.
Okay.
So not many people, you know, are able to use that tax deduction that you get from your interests. You got to own a home more than $200,000 to be able to get the tax deduction based on your interest rate.
Well, I think everybody in Orange County qualifies.
I think
for
we all made that one. Yeah.
I don't think you can buy an apartment for $200,000.
I agree with you, but that's looking at it very specifically. We're talking about overall. And when they file their taxes, it's not just Orange County people who file their taxes. Everybody in the U.S. files taxes.
Well, I'm always thrilled every week you come on and you tell me good news about Orange County real estate. So I feel confident. And we were afraid interest rates are going to go up. Nah, it didn't matter. We were afraid that elections coming. Ah, it doesn't matter. There's nothing in the horizon that seems to cool off Orange County.
First of all, I don't see why interest rate needs to go up. Everything seems to be working fine. There is some concern of what's happening in Europe or Japan or China.
Big concern,
You know, interest rates are going to stay the same probably for the next 6 to 9 months, I think.
Except if they want to artificially raise it so they can later drop it and do something. Right now they got no arrows in their quiver here. Yeah.
Well, I actually read a really interesting article talking about, you know, how would negative rates work in U.S.?
Oh, let's explain that idea, because that's mind-boggling to most people. I don't think people even know that there are places in the world where negative rates, you almost get paid to put your money in the bank.
No, you have to actually pay the bank to keep your money in the bank.
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, right.
Now, in this article, it talks about how like a 0.5% drop in U.S. interest rate, what would mm-hmm. happen. And it was talking about how the bank would actually make less money if they did that. And it used a couple of examples. Like if they were to drop the interest rate by 0.5% mm-hmm. in the negative zone, like Capital One Financial, they would go to about 5% decline in earning per share from 1.4 to 5%.
Wow.
Bank of America would go down by earning per share would be reduced by 7%. Those are one of the negatives.
And
they've had this negative interest rate.
Why would the bank lose money?
I'll explain that to you actually. In Denmark, they had negative interest rates for 4 years. They're the only country which have it for 4 years, you mm-hmm. know, longest.
Okay.
And they're talking about actually a couple which have a negative on the mortgage. So a bank actually mailed them a check one quarter.
Negative mortgage, or I'm talking about negative interest rate?
This is negative interest rate, right? But their mortgage actually went down, so the bank actually mailed them a check. Now, the banks are making their money only on fees they charge. And remember, their banks put their money in the central banks, mm-hmm. which is going to cost them to put it there when it's negative mortgage. That means if I'm Bank of America and I need to keep my money at Federal Reserve, I have to pay to keep that money. That's costly to the bank. Banks cannot make money. In fact, in Sweden, Denmark, and Norway, they're worried that some big banks may go out of business because of negative mortgage, especially in Norway, because Norway depends on, they have oil, you know,
yeah.
they depend on oil money,
North
and now
sea,
that the price
yeah.
has gone down, they're concerned that this may cause more problems.
Well, you know, it's in this article, it also talks about how six central banks in Europe and Japan have imposed negative rates.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, their loan growth has picked up in some part of Europe and sub-zero rates. So there's different...
Well, it's good for the consumer. Don't get me wrong. It's very good. In fact, one of the concerns in the Scandinavian countries is that the people may speculate too much because the rates are so good. People are actually buying more real estate. And if the rates ever
free
go
money.
Up,
yeah, go get it from
exactly.
the bank.
Exactly. And if the rates go up, they could cause major collapse of the real estate. That's one of the concerns they have, plus the banks. Banks are losing money. And that's not good for the economy, too. So there is a dilemma there, you know. It's what's good for the...
when you were also talking about this article about how, like, why does negative interest rate in Japan affect our real estate
Orange? That's a different thing. Why does the rate... why is it that...
The negative rate of growth.
Negative rate of growth. They have less infants being born in Japan. Why is it causing our real estate to go up here? Cool. And that's what I was
saying. And that is, you know, there used to be a thing, a chaos theory, and it said if a butterfly flexes its wings, how does that cause a hurricane in some other part of the world? And chaos theory will explain in great detail how one little change in this interconnected world can lead to major changes somewhere else. That's the dramatic point of the story.
So you've got
one of these.
In this case, the Japanese population is getting older. And
right.
the rate of growth of infants is actually going down a lot.
Right.
That means the insurance companies need to provide more for the older population. As the population gets older, we more in need
they're
of
paying
health.
Out more. Yeah.
Exactly. So they need to invest. They can invest in Japan because there's negative rate there. And if they invested in America, in T-bills, you probably get what? 1% or whatever, if you're lucky. So what they've done is they've started investing in real estate.
And ouch! We don't need them in Orange County.
Yeah.
And they're
Japanese insurance companies who need to make more money to pay for the older people they're insuring are bringing money here, and the best investment they see is housing.
It's housing, and they're buying these huge apartment complexes, big condominium complexes, because they get good return on it. And that's one of the reasons why the prices are going
just
up.
Just keep propping it up. So they're just pouring money into it, and when you pour money into it, prices go up.
Exactly. And so because there's limited supply of housing wherever you look at
it. How about the Chinese? You said they're not. There's some anecdotal evidence that's slowing down a bit.
The Chinese buying, actually in Irvine, specifically in Irvine, I don't know about the Lake County, it is going down. In Irvine, most of the new homes are bought by Asians.
Right.
And the majority of the Asians are from China.
Right.
But in the recent couple of months, that has gone down, and mainly because of the problem with the Chinese economy and so on.
Is it harder to bring money over?
I guess so. I don't even know how they brought it before, because I don't think it's easy in China to go to your bank and say, I want to wire $1 million.
I think it's actually forbidden to take money out of the
right.
country, and that's why they're doing it. But if you buy assets out of the country, if you come over here and buy furs and diamonds and stuff, you've effectively turned currency into something convertible that you can carry with you. And the theory is that by buying, I don't know how they buy housing here, but if they can do it, they have taken money that they've made over there and turned it into an asset over here that they've made the money, they brought the money out of the country.
Yeah, but I've actually seen, Paul, a huge amount of money. I know a couple of years ago, I met a couple of Japanese people. They had brought $100 million in dollars. I don't know how that's done. I'm sure it must be third parties do it, because
shell corporations and
probably.
Right.
Otherwise, it's not that easy to bring money out of China.
Right.
But it seems that it's kind of dried up.
And the theory is that the Chinese economy is either in for a fall, or their real fear is another cultural revolution where the peasants wake up and say, look at all these rich people that have, as we've moved to a capitalist sort of communist version of communism, all these people are billionaires. How come I didn't get mine? How you ripped us all off? And they're going to come with pitchforks and get rid of them all.
I'm not sure about that, but it is possible that I think the economy is not doing as good as we thought, although the
figures publicly said. But the thing is, you can't really rely on the data they issue, because it's kind of it's an unknown what really is.
That's right. Government controls
the data.
That's
the problem. That's why we can't be sure of how exactly is the economy doing, how good it is, and so on.
Oh, I had an article for you guys. Keep talking here. Go ahead.
Well, I just want to kind of point out what it's coming on the economic calendar. The Federal Reserve is going to meet April 26th and the 27th.
On Wednesday, yeah.
They're not going to, I mean, the consensus out there is they're not going to raise the interest rate, but, you know, what their statement following the two-day meeting will give us some clue as what they will be doing in the, you know, in June. So everybody's going to look into what they're going to say. The Commerce Department first reading of the GDP number comes out on Thursday, which gives us the snapshot of the economy during the first 3 months of the year. On Friday, the Commerce Department will release data on the income and outlays, sales at retails and restaurants slid 0.3% in March. So we're going to know, how the consumer is spending their money. And I think factory floors.
Mortgage Bank is actually going to come out with a report of who's borrowing and where they're borrowing. That's
a whole bunch of stuff coming out in the next week or two here.
Every week we have stuff, but the employment cost index, which is basically, it shows, you know, whether the labor market is getting tight, is there going to be and it measures wage growth. That comes out on Friday, I believe. And on Tuesday, there's the durable goods report that's going to come out by the, by Commerce Department. So we have a full week of data.
So let me ask you the hard question. I'm going to cut right to the bottom line. Does any of that portend, there's a fancy word, does any of that predict tough roads ahead? And even if there are, does that going to slow down the Orange County growth?
I don't think it's going to affect Orange County.
I don't think it's going to, but it is
a lot
going
of
to
these
affect the
figures,
interest rate.
Yeah, a lot of these figures that are coming are the national. Mm-hmm. And it will affect some other areas of the country. But Orange County,
you seem to be immune to this for the moment.
Specifically Southern California, with the exception of San Bernardino and some parts of Riverside, are doing very well, actually, in terms of real estate.
Well, you always have to remember, for bad news is good news for the interest rate market. Hmm. It's the reverse. So if you people are losing their job and you were not doing well in the economy, which means it's supply and demand, mm-hmm. what's going to happen? They're not going to raise the interest rate if they're, so it has the reverse effects.
Right.
So we'll see. I mean, it will get some clue as what the Federal Reserve's, is thinking on after their meeting this week.
All right, we got to take a quick break. We'll come back and talk about, what are we going to talk about, adjustable interest rates?
Yes, I want to talk about it.
Is there such a thing as adjustables anymore?
We'll find out.
All right, right after this. Hang around.
Imagine what it would feel like to lose everything. Your job, your home, your family, your dignity. This has happened to thousands of the men, women, veterans, and young adults we serve at Working Wardrobes. What do we do to help? We provide career development services, life skills workshops, job skills training. We provide the perfect interview outfit, and we get clients placed in jobs. Call Working Wardrobes, 714-210-2460. Donate, volunteer, invest, hire.
When it comes to pioneers in their respective industries, we all know the Apples, Starbucks, and Trader Joe's of the world. In the realm of recruiting, Decision Toolbox is the industry's best-kept secret. With 90% of their business from referrals and repeat customers, for over 20 years, Decision Toolbox's U.S.-based team of recruiters, sourcers, professional writers, quality personnel, and tech support has perfected a Six Sigma approach to talent management. No matter the size of the project, Decision Toolbox delivers incredible results. A cost per hire less than half of what contingency firms charge. with the winning candidate presented in an average of 14 days, all with a 12-month candidate warranty. With results like that, Decision Toolbox won't be a secret for long. Visit us at www.dtoolbox.com for more information.
Faye, before we go to adjustable, let me just say one last thing about rents in the county. I want to go over each county in Southern California.
All right.
Orange County has got the highest average rent, and this is average, by the way. It's $17.36 versus L.A. County, which is $14.16. San Diego is actually $15.77, and San Bernardino, Riverside is $12.39.
Wow, these are the average.
So, Orange County is actually, on average, is more expensive to rent than, say, even L.A. County. Although L.A. County is
different areas.
Exactly.
If you L.A. County is so big and it has so many diverse areas. Yeah.
Exactly. That's one why it's lower. But in specific areas, it is more expensive in L.A. County.
Okay, so
let's talk about adjustable loans.
Adjustable, those are gone. Those are out of date.
What does adjustable means to you, Paul?
Adjustable means to me that every so often the bank can adjust it and charge me more money.
Well, not necessarily charge you more money. If you had actually got an adjustable loan 10, 15 years ago, mm-hmm. and you'd probably be paying less than a fixed rate.
I had an adjustable, and then when the crash came, I refinanced and got a fix because everybody said, oh, you got a chance to get a low fixed rate. That's much better than this potentially high adjustable rate.
Well, an adjustable, right now there is...
I made a bad deal.
Well, you didn't make a bad deal. Because when you change your loan from an adjustable loan to a fixed rate, you may not come out okay. I did it myself when, some 20, 30 years ago. We thought like we did a good thing.
Yeah.
But had we kept our adjustable, we would have actually probably paid half of what we paid on the fixed rate. When you change your loan to a fixed rate, it's really more about your peace of mind.
Yes. Fixing the potential, whatever you want to call it, the downside. It can only get so bad. It's a fixed rate. It can't go up to... Because my adjustable could have gone up to, 18% or some crazy thing.
Well, most adjustables that people have right now, it's probably their cap probably is not higher than 10%.
Maybe it was 10, 11, but it was a scary enough number that I said, well, I better get out of that and get a fixed rate.
Well, when you have an adjustable, what is an adjustable rate? Well, an adjustable interest rate is the term of the loan. Let's say if you have a 30-year loan, sometime within that time period, your rate is going to change. It's not going to stay exactly the same for the duration.
Doesn't it go up a couple times? There were sort of anniversary marks. It could go up or down depending on...
Right now, really, the adjustables that are out there, we call them intermediate arm. But an intermediate arm means is like it's fixed for a time period. Mm-hmm. Let's say we call 5-1. What does a 5-1 mean to a consumer? You're fixed for 5 years.
Right.
At the end of the 5 years, you become adjustable.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how does that adjustable work? So now you have a 7-1, which is fixed for 7 years. End of 7 years, you become adjustable. We have the 10-1.
And does the 1 mean annually it's adjusted?
And it adjusts annually. And there's some that would adjust, every 6 months. But if it's a 10-1, 7-1, 5-1, 3-1, 1-1, it means after that time period, you adjust. Now, when you do adjust, and this is something that people never pay attention to when they take an adjustable, it really is your index plus margin that would set what your interest rate would be.
Index plus margin.
What is an index?
Well, most adjustables that are sold out right now, it's on a LIBOR index. Now, LIBOR index stands for London Interbank Offered Rate. That is the actual, it's the average interest rate estimated by each of the leading banks in London that can be charged from one bank to the other.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically the rate that
the banks charge one another.
And LIBOR became a more common thing. Before that, it was something else.
Coffee. We used to call it cost of funds.
11th district.
11th district cost of funds.
And it was a different index. Now, you could also, your index can also be like a treasury bill, a one-year,
yes.
three-year, five-year. So you have an index, whatever that index is. then you add the margin to it.
And let's stop for 1 second. So some indexes, because there were different indexes chosen, some of them are more volatile. Some of them are more stable. Some of them hop up and down faster. Some of them take longer to adjust.
Correct.
Is LIBOR a more volatile one or a more stable
index? It's a more stable one, actually. That's
what
it says.
Well, I begged to differ on that because really to me they're all volatile because you know you could look at it like because at the end of the day you look at an index and you look at its history of it mm-hmm. and you try to predict the future by history but you know one thing we know it could change
sure.
in the next day so the LIBOR
clearly the banks have decided for some reason to follow one index for another and I'm assuming it's because they have a greater risk of or greater opportunity to make money.
Well, number one, it's more available, it's easier to monitor. Number two, it is less volatile. I know what Faye says, I agree with her, anything can change anytime, but historically some indexes are less volatile than the others,
right?
So the LIBOR was more widely available number and banks used it. Now, a couple of years ago, if you remember, there was some cheating going on LIBOR and there was a major lawsuit going on and so on because I guess the number was reported incorrectly and a lot of big investors actually sued because it cost them a lot of money.
Sure.
So
there's an index involved and that's when it comes to adjust, they say, did this index go up or down, and that adjusts your rate.
And then they add that to your margin that's specified.
I'll give you an example. You wanted to know what the LIBOR index. The LIBOR index right now, it's under 1% or close to 1%. If you go back to history, it was like back in 1989, that index was about 9%.
Wow.
And it's been kind of going down every year since then. That's probably the highest it's been since 1989. The lowest, I think, it's been the last few years where it's been under 1%. And like right now, I believe, hold on a second, if you want to know exactly.
And while you're looking, then tell me what the average margin is, how much they add to that index.
The margin is what actually, so let's say right now the LIBOR index, the one-year LIBOR index, 1.217.
Okay.
Most adjustables run between 2 to 3% on their margin. But that's one thing nobody looks at because when you set your
LIBOR index.
Your adjustable
they're going to lock it in, say here's your rate.
You know, I remember back in the days when we had negative amortization and people would actually ask me if that 1.99% that was being offered by the bank is like they actually thought that's what they were going to pay on their interest rate. Well, my answer was, well, how much do you get if you put your money in the bank? And back then you could get 2-3% putting your bank. And my answer would be, if you put your money in the bank and you're getting 3% out of it, how could the bank be lending it to you? 1.99%. So, like, you really on an adjustable, you really have to educate yourself. So, right now, the most Fannie, Freddie, they run between 2.25 to about 2.5%.
So, they take the index and they add a margin to it. They add something on top of that, which is their profit, right?
Well, which is really their profit. So, if right now, let's say the your 1.2%, or let's say it's 1%, the index. So if you add that 2.5 to it, that'll become 3.5, like 3.2 or 3.7. That's why if you've had an adjustable in the last five to 10 years, you've been in under 4%.
Yeah.
So, and there are many loans that are still out there that are not, refinance.
Because I think I am at like 4 or 5% that I locked it in thinking I was a genius, avoiding the potential it could go to 10 or 11, which was the cap on the adjustable. And you're saying, I wasn't so smart because I'm locked in at 4 or 5, and the adjustable,
I'm... You heard the part that you wanted to hear.
Yeah, like, always.
Any other consumer. What I said is when you fix your rate, you're giving yourself a peace of mind.
Yes.
That's what you pay for.
That's what
for,
I did, right.
Okay. But, like, you know, people in, like, in Orange County, and most people move every 5 to 7 years. So, if, you know, one option is would be, like, to go for a 7-1. A 7-1, you're fixed for 7 years, and then you become adjustable.
And probably by then you've moved.
So, if you're thinking you're not going to be in the home for more than 5 to 7 years, that may not be a bad option for you. So, you want to look at that. Now, on average, a 5 year, it's probably about 3/4% lower than a fixed rate. So really, you have to really look at the risk and reward.
Because it is lower. They are still lower. Because that's why I get it.
They are still lower. Yes, yeah. They are still lower, but not as much. I mean, at one point it was about 1% lower, but now it's the margin has like become less. So
yeah, that's why we did it, because it was a lower
question
rate.
LIBOR has a 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, and a year. Which one do they use?
1 year LIBOR.
They use a 1 year.
Well,
LIBOR.
Depends. It depends on how your note was written, because you can have a 6 month LIBOR, you can have a 1 year LIBOR. So. So right now, the Fannie, the adjustables on the conforming
loan. So check how often it adjusts.
Well, so what you want to know is exactly what index you're getting. So if you're a consumer and you're thinking, hey, I'm not going to be in this house for more than 5 years, I would say what you're thinking, you may be okay to go for a 7-1. Mm-hmm. And that way, you're giving yourself an extra 2 years.
But to Hamid's point, are there some loans that say LIBOR and they're going to use the 3-month moving average, or are there some that say, are they all using the 1 year?
Well, it's not all fit all. You know,
all the
it's
same.
All the same. It's, you have to read your actual note. What is given to you. And that's why it's a little bit tricky, because as a consumer, it's hard enough to figure out the fixed rate. Now, think about all the things that could be moving in an adjustable.
The shorter, there's like if it's a 1 month LIBOR, 3 months, it's more volatile.
That's what I would think, yeah.
Well, it's cheaper too. That index is lower.
That's cheaper volatile.
Got it.
Well, here's how it works. So you have an index plus the margin that will give you the interest rate. But then you have a first cap adjustment, and then you have a subsequent adjustment cap, and then you have a life cap. So the
How much it can go up in one shot, and how much can go up over the life of the loan?
Well, no. When you have an adjustable, you have your first adjustment cap,
right?
Which means the first time you adjust. So let's say where you're taking a 5 year adjustable.
Mm-hmm.
End of the 5 year, your first adjustment cap. Is it could be 2%, it could be 5%.
So that's saying no matter what the market really is at that point, we're going to cap it at a certain rate.
First adjustment cap.
Right.
So when you have an adjustable, you have the first adjustment cap, which you probably want it to be no higher than 2%.
Okay.
Now, then you have your subsequent, which means like...
Or as we say, subsequent.
The sixth, the seventh, the eighth year, right?
Yes.
Those are like, that's also a cap. So that's like most adjustable, like a Fannie adjustable is 2%. It's 2% first one and 2% subsequent.
Yeah.
And then you have a life cap, which says where you start, it can never be higher than, let's say, 5% of where you start.
I think mine was 11 or something in the day.
So let's
usually
say
5%,
right now, an adjustable, a 7 year adjustable, you're probably running between 3 to 3.5%, depending, you know, on the product, your credit score. There's a variety of factor that goes in there. And then you also, so let's say if you got an adjustable with a 3.5% first adjustment, like the first, your initial rate, if you have a life cap of 5%, you can never be higher than 8.5%.
Right.
So
overall, your overall rate can't be more than the original rate of 3 plus the cap, additional 5, so 8 is your top cap in that scenario.
Now, why, as a consumer, I think, if I were ever going to take an adjustable, these are the things that I'm going to look, that I'm going to sit down and calculate for myself.
All right.
What is my payment at the maximum?
Mm.
So if my payment is, let's say, $5,000 and I don't see any way I could make that payment, I probably wouldn't go with an adjustable.
Even though you're rolling the dice and saying, it's never going to get there.
Yes, but...
That's what happened. That's why we had the crash, actually. A lot of people got those adjustables that she was talking about, 1.99 or something.
Yeah, but those are different. Those are, like, different. Like, you don't make... These are the what we talked about, intermediate arm, which is, to me, is still more stable than, like, right-out adjustable, because you're fixed for 5 years. You're fixed for 7 years. Now, if you're certain you're going to be out of that house...
No risk.
No risk. But think about it. Well, what if you're not out of that house? Do you have any means of... Well, do you have any means of paying that mortgage off if you do? Well, some people do, Paul. Yeah. Some people. So these are the factors you have to look at it.
Or you can refinance with that money.
Well, what if you can't afford to? Like, you don't qualify to refinance. So these are the factors you have to look at.
So wouldn't it be fair to say that an adjustable is a form of gambling? You're deciding how long you're going to play the game and what the risk is, and if it went to its all-time high, which you don't think it's going to, you're betting it's not, but if it did, what could you pay
back? Yes, yeah. I think that's what you need to ask yourself. If you're going to take an adjustable, you want to look at your maximum, which is your worst-case scenario, and think about it. Well, if I get there, do I have the means of, like, paying off the mortgage?
So my assumption, young person, 20 years ago, if it gets to 11, I can't make that payment. But I'll be gone long before then. I'll sell, I'll move, I'll refinance. I won't wait until it gets to 11. I'm going to start choking around 6 or 7 or 8. I'll get out by then.
Well, so if you had an adjustable that was tied to a LIBOR index in the last, since 2007,
mine wasn't.
2008,
mine was tied to the
it's
old,
been like under 1.5%. Yeah. So you wouldn't have paid more than 3 to 4%.
So here's my question. You're saying be cautious, look at the worst case scenario, and decide if you feel comfortable having that looming over your head as a potential scenario. Could happen. And if you don't have an appetite for that kind of risk, don't do it. Or if you don't think you could pay it, don't do it. But then in the same breath, you're telling me it's been a pretty steady, stable product. It hasn't, over the last 10 years. It's been, in fact, lower than the fixed rate market.
I understand what I'm saying, but you have to look at your own personality.
Right. That's also history, Paul. It doesn't mean it's future.
Yes, well, that's
the problem. That's the problem.
I think it would be very... I mean, I don't think any of us can sit here and predict what's going to happen with the LIBOR index.
Okay. So, that being said, are many people writing these things anymore? Because my assumption was with fixed rates as low as they are, everybody's going towards the safe, steady product rather than the risky, might-happen product here.
Well, there are people out there they're saying, I'm not going to stay. You know, I've got a project here. I'm buying this house on top, so I'm going to stay here for 5 years. So, you really, at the end of the day, our whole purpose is to educate the consumer.
Clearly.
So I think...
But do you see, you're out there in the market, I would think there was a time when everybody I knew had an adjustable. Very few people could afford the fixed rates. Now the fixed rates are so cheap, it seems like everybody has those. I don't know why, other than those scenarios where people know they're going to be out, why would anybody take the risk?
Well, sometimes people take it because that's the only thing they can afford to.
Which leads to my next question. We've talked so many times about first-time homebuyers. Is this a first-time homebuyer option, that there is an adjustable rate and it's a higher risk, but the assumption is you're a first-time homebuyer and you'll be out of it before that?
Well, actually, FHA has a 5-1.
Mm-hmm.
And FHA's 5-1 is not a bad option because it can only adjust 1% a year. So after the 5 years, the adjustment cap is only 1%.
There you go.
But it's like you said, there is not that big of a difference between being an adjustable versus fixed. So that there is not enough incentive for you to take that risk. Because what you want to do, I think if I were going to take an adjustable, I would write down my monthly payment on a fix, and what would it be on the adjustable, and look at my lifetime savings. So if I'm saving myself, let's say, I don't know, $500 per month, and that's like $6,000 a year. So at the end of the 5 years, I've got $30,000. Mm-hmm. I would probably put that extra money into my principal because I would come ahead. Or, but nobody's going to really be that $500.
So let me ask you then
probably talking about 100 to 100.
The other advantage, and I don't know if they're even offering these anymore, is what you talk about the negative amortization. I had one of those too. And for a long time, I thought, you know, I'm never going to pay off this house. I'm going to sell it long before it's paid off. So I'll take that savings up. I'll I'll pay less than the loan demands and increase my loan value slightly, but I'm going to bet that the house goes up faster than that goes up. So that negative amortization didn't seem like it hurt me during that period of time.
Well, back in the day when I had studied in the mortgage industry, we used to call that the doctor's loan. Mm. Because we would only give those loans to, let's say, a doctor or an attorney. And the whole idea behind that negative amortization was if you're a doctor in residency or you're an attorney and you're just starting to work, your income is lower.
Right.
But you got a potential within 5 to 10 years, you're going to be making so much more money that negative upfront should not hurt you. Mm-hmm. It was not built for somebody with fixed income. Like, it wasn't built for a school teacher. Like,
right.
And what happened, people actually abused this negative amortization, and that's why it went away.
Mm.
I don't know of anybody that actually offers it now. But it wasn't a bad choice. It fitted certain people, but it wasn't for regular.
Yeah, I found myself saying, well, why am I going to make the higher payment this month? I'd rather just add it to the loan, that little bit to the loan, because the house is accumulating faster than that is. I'd rather use that money for something else today here.
Actually, I know somebody, one of our neighbors, that did that. They kept their adjustable back in 1988,
I think it was 89. He's paid off by now.
Yeah, and then as the rates went down, he kept paying the same amount that he would have if he had the fixed rate.
Yeah.
And he paid off his house much faster because the rate just kept going down and he kept paying more principal each time.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I think the whole idea is like you can't think like you did. Okay?
That's the underlying theme of the show. Don't do it, Paul.
No. But what it is if you're making that saving, if you pay back your debt, you're paying less on the life of the loan.
Yeah.
I'll give you an example. Like, if you pay one extra payment a year,
mm-hmm,
on a 30-year loan, your payoff will go down to about 22 to 23
wow.
years. So paying a little extra, and why is that? Because it's like every, let's say, $100 that I pay extra today, I would have paid interest on it for the next 30 years.
Yeah, right.
That's what you're reducing. So if you're going with that mentality, you really have to see what your saving is. And if you put that back into the home, I think it's okay. But to say, I'm going to just delay it for the future, it's probably not a good financial decision.
Don't do it, Paul.
Unless you're
folks.
A doctor, like in residency, yeah, and you're going to make mega millions, so you don't really care about like this.
That's right.
Petty stuff today.
But that's not a common feature anymore, a negative loan amortization.
I mean, there were good products back when they were available, but they were not for everybody. And you know, it was misused, and that's it. They took it away.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So while adjustables are still available, they are a little bit cheaper, but not that much cheaper. And so most people aren't taking the risk. Am I correct? They're a little cheaper, but not that much. And therefore, most people are shying away from them.
Yes. And I mean, right now, I would say if you really wanted to pay the cheapest interest rate, you may want to look at a 15-year mortgage, because on a 15-year mortgage, you can even actually go under, you could go much lower. Like, you know, it's on average a probably a 15-year is about probably 3/4 to about a 1% cheaper,
really,
than a 30-year.
Let's talk about that next week, because I didn't know there was even a 15-year loan product and that it was cheaper. I thought everything's always 30.
No. You have 10-year fix, you have 15-year fix, you have 20-year fix, you got 25-year
fix. Just like I didn't know anybody's doing adjustables anymore. I thought...
You actually have 40 years too, which is by HUD, but that's very rare that you would do that.
Well, no, they used to be available too, and then I think... a lot of people that got modified, every one of them, like a lot of them, they basically took them from a 30 and dumped them into a 40 years, and they think they came ahead. It's just
What happened to me, basically. Yeah, it seems like I'll never pay it off now. Here,
yeah, now you'll never pay it off. I've actually, I look at people modification. I've yet to see one that actually
saved them money.
Saved any money.
Did you modify your loan, Paul?
Yeah, we did. During the Great Recession or whatever here.
Oh, I see. I didn't know that. I thought...
Yeah. So we left the adjustable to get the fixed, and they did it. And that could be a whole stupid story unto itself here. And now it seems like all they did is they waived some payments up front, but just extended it in the back. And now all I've got is a new loan, a new 30 or 40-year loan that I'll never pay off here.
Well, when I do the math and I actually do analyze, every one of my customers actually did a loan modification. Mm-hmm. that I've actually looked at, I've yet to see somebody actually
save money.
It's always been to the bank's advantage, but it seems like the way they just give you that payment, and if you don't look at anything beyond the actual payment, you're really
And that was it. The payment went down, and they waived about 6 months' worth of payments. And I thought, hallelujah, oh, wow. And then all they did is just tack it on the end. And
because if you're ever going to sell the house, they'll collect it from you.
Right. So it was not as advantageous. I wish I'd known you guys a long time ago.
So you
a lot richer.
Orange County housing.
You should have listened to our show.
Everybody should listen to this show. We really should get more people out there and aware of this stuff here. Do you ever do seminars and that kind of stuff again to hear any of this stuff here?
Faded seminars.
I used to do, but I've been very busy with this show and a lot of projects that I have. So, I love to teach. So that's probably something I want to do.
We're probably going to have some more soon. We'll let our listeners know when they're coming along.
All right.
Well, it looks like that's it for today. Thank you for listening. Make sure you check our Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat, all under OCHC Radio. And if you have any questions or comments or concerns, please email us at OCHCRadio@gmail.com.
And stick around. We have our weekly tip, Green Tip of the Week from Green Eileen.
Hey, everybody. Green Eileen with your Green Tip of the Week. And on Friday, we just had Earth Day. Every April 22nd, we have Earth Day. It's something that's celebrated all across the globe. But it started in the 70s. It was a movement where people wanted to make a point of how we are polluting our Earth. And one thing that came out of it that we're still doing today is recycling. So we are recycling glass, paper, metal, plastic, all those things. But that, you know, let's talk about it. That was in the 1970s. We're talking decades later. We're still recycling. How can we take it up a notch? And the way we could take it up a notch is actually by purchasing products that are made out of recycled materials. And you find them everywhere. You could find them in the grocery store. You find them at Home Depot. You find them at your local 7-Eleven. There's lots of different places where you could find products made out of recycled materials. And I highly recommend it merely because of an economic standpoint, supply and demand. You're having a product that's already been used. You put in the recycle bin, but in order to perpetuate that cycle, we need to be a lot more conscious of what we could purchase that's made out of recycled products. So checking out those labels and where you can make that contribution and contribute to the supply and demand of recycling is your Green Tip of the Week from Green Eileen.